It was clearly a landmark game in the history of soccer in this country. It was a turning point. It was a Cinderella story. It was wonderful. I mean, it began to put soccer on the map in the country. But also, to me, the even more important aspect is the way this team came together.
That was author Jeffrey Douglas, and this is Founding Football. I've been to St. Louis exactly once, for a work trip. I stayed in a Hilton near the airport, I ate two meals in that hotel restaurant, and traveled to my meeting by cab. Yes, I was definitely lame, but this was over 10 years ago, and if I had ventured out, which I definitely should have, but if I had, I would have gone to see the Gateway Arch, and I probably would have gone to see Busch Stadium. See, baseball was my first love, baseball cards a passion, playing the game my religion. When Mitchell and Ness brought back throwback jerseys and fitted hats, they were perpetually on my birthday and Christmas lists. If memory serves me, I owned a throwback Cardinals hat at one point, and I know that I definitely owned a St. Louis Browns hat. I would have sought out the backstories of Stan Musial and Bob Gibson, the landing spot of Mark McGwire's recent home runs, and it would have been interesting to understand where Vince Coleman, and before him Lou Brock, made base stealing fashionable. I definitely would not have gone to see the Hill. Nothing in the recesses of my brain would have urged me to check out the birthplace of baseball greats Yogi Berra and Joe Garagiola. A hidden piece of baseball history in its own right would have gone right between my fingers. And even still, if I had visited the Hill to check out the city's well-known old Italian neighborhood, I would have missed the chance to learn about four men arguably more important to American sport's current fabric than Berra and Garagiola. I'd have walked right through the birthplace of Frank Borghi, Frank Pee Wee Wallace, Gino Pariani, and Charles Colombo. I'd have spent no time understanding how those four, plus another St. Louis native, Harry Keough, were vital to the ascension of modern soccer in America. How can five men, whose names are virtually anonymous, be potentially more important to the current landscape of sports in America than the great Berra and the effervescent Garagiola, the guy who became a TV icon after he was a baseball star? Well, soccer didn't start in America on June 29th, 1950, but the 1950 U.S. men's national team impossible victory over England that day in the World Cup was an anchor moment, our first moment, in the decades-long journey that soccer has taken back to prominence in America. Five St. Louis natives drove that victory, and one became an indispensable spirit of the game in America for decades to follow. This moment, these men, without them, we may still be looking for America to embrace the world's game, but with them as the first catalyst in a long journey, we're here. And next time I go to St. Louis, I'll visit the Hill because of them. Welcome to Founding Football. I'm your host, Kent Malmrose. This podcast is a year-long exploration of the critical events that have collectively made soccer popular in America. Today's episode is Chapter 1, the United States versus England in the 1950 World Cup, the first of 52 moments this podcast is highlighting that have contributed to soccer's popularity in America. If you didn't listen to our episode on the soccer war, you may not have heard the spiel, so we'll do it one more time. Soccer is popular in America, and the data is absolutely inarguable. Between 1937 and 1972, according to Gallup polling, less than 0.5%, one half of 1% of Americans, said soccer was their favorite sport to watch. And even through December of 2004, the percentage never rose above 2%. That's after the 1994 World Cup, after the 99ers, after big moments in American soccer. But then, during the excitement that surrounded the 2022 World Cup, there was a very different story. 8% of Americans name soccer as their favorite sport to watch in a Washington Post poll. That may seem small, but that's nearly as many Americans citing soccer as basketball at 12% or baseball at 11%. It was higher than motor racing, considered a prominent and dominant American sport. 31% of Americans say they are soccer fans on some level now. Soccer is here. It's part of the American sports landscape. And we've gotten here moment by moment. In this episode, we're going to explore how a group of soccer players representing the United States delivered what is possibly the greatest upset in the history of soccer, maybe in the history of sports, in the World Cup, in Brazil, against England. Let's set the stage a little. The 1950 World Cup game wasn't special because it was the first time the U.S. reached the tournament, or the first time it faced top competition on foreign soil. The U.S. fielded a team and finished third in the World Cup in 1930. That was the first World Cup in Uruguay, and it's still the best ever result for our country in the World Cup. Then in 1934, the U.S. qualified again before losing its first game to Italy 7-1. World War II limited the 38 competition, then the 42 and 46 tournaments. They just didn't happen at all, which made it even harder for America to try to regain any international soccer momentum. A downward trend on top of a downward trend coming off the soccer war. It's safe to say that by 1950, when the World Cup returned, America simply wasn't thinking about it. We weren't a soccer nation at that point. And Harry Truman was president facing the realities of the Korean War. Disney released Cinderella, its 12th feature-length film. Charles Schwartz published Peanuts for the first time. Barra and Joe DiMaggio were the big baseball names of the day. We weren't relevant in the international soccer world. Actually, we might have been worse than that. We may have been a joke. Either way, we were headed to the World Cup in Brazil in June of 1950, at very least to play our group games, one of which was against England on the 29th. Meanwhile, England's presence at the competition was far and away the biggest story surrounding it. They were the unquestioned strongest team in the world. They had stars like Stanley Matthews. He was considered the best player in the game at the time, alongside Wilf Mannion and Tom Finney. They walked into the World Cup with 3-1 odds to win the whole thing, and frankly, it was just assumed they would bring home the trophy. This was also supposed to be their triumphant return to the world stage. See, for decades, they had a complicated relationship with FIFA, having withdrawn from the organization in 1928, meaning they missed the previous World Cups, the first one and the other ones that followed. Once England learned that it would play the U.S. in the group round, the question wasn't the outcome, but rather how lopsided would that outcome be? Could England score double digits against the lowly Americans? Remember, this is a team that, before somehow qualifying for the World Cup, had been outscored 45-2. Yes, you heard that right. 45-2 in seven straight international matches. Here's the first way we can see the reason that this game became important. We were trending in the opposite direction to the rest of the world. We were playing the world's powerhouse, and we needed that trend to stop. Despite being terrible, the U.S. did manage to qualify for that 1950 tournament with two wins against Cuba. And that was right after those seven straight drubbings. So as June 1950 approached, Walter Geisler, a St. Louis native who was the Federation's president and chief scout, he had to put a team together. It's hard to imagine a one-man band type arrangement leading the national team or running the U.S. Soccer Federation when you consider how it works today. There are layers and layers of executives, layers of coaches, layers of scouts, bureaucracy, politics, but that's not the way it was then. See, Geisler organized tryouts in Los Angeles, St. Louis, Chicago, and New York pretty much by himself and built a roster of 15 players based on those tryouts. Six, as it were, originated from St. Louis. Five, as we alluded to earlier, would start and play a key role in the England matchup. The roster also had players from Philadelphia and Long Island. They were Italian, Belgian, Portuguese, Haitian, Irish, Scottish, and German. 8 were American citizens and the rest were not. See, at the time, you only had to express your interest in becoming a citizen to be considered for the team. Some worked at funeral homes, meatpacking plants, some worked as dishwashers. They weren't professional soccer players, except for one, that is. We'll talk about that in a minute. Most of the players made some extra money playing soccer, even good money relative to their regular pay, but it wasn't enough to make a full-time living and support their families. See, they were in fact the perfect encapsulation of America at the time. They were people who played soccer because of their backgrounds and heritage, because of a familial love for the game. Not because there was any real chance to play professionally at that point, or even for national glory. Their collective soccer identity was that of a melting pot. Different styles from different influences brought together to play as one for just the first time in a scrimmage in New York City 2 weeks before leaving for Brazil. See, if we're thinking about moments that began soccer's journey towards popularity in America, it was just these types of moments. Those that gave America ownership of the game in a purely American way. A bunch of guys from varying immigrant communities working hard jobs, pursuing the American dream, and playing the games of their homeland on the side, playing it now in and for their new country, trying to forge a soccer identity for America. It was a moment that let us begin to see the game in our own image. We had a setting, we had a plot line, now we needed a cast. And the cast of characters and those specifics are worth knowing because they bring to life the unique, very American nature of this group. There were two Philadelphians, Walter Barr and Ed McIlvenny, both halfbacks on the team. McIlvenny, he was the one that earned a living playing pro soccer, the only one on the team, and it's worth noting to recent fans of the American soccer culture that Ed, he played at Wrexham in Scotland, having signed there in 1947. Yep, that Wrexham. Meanwhile, Barr was a gym teacher in his hometown of Philadelphia, making $2,400 a year at John Paul Jones Junior High School, and then $25 every Sunday, playing for the Philadelphia Nationals of the American Soccer League, which was a pro league, but it was still a part-time job for Barr. The center half that played between them was Charlie Colombo. That starts the long line of St. Louis natives and was part of the group that grew up on the Hill. Colombo was a clerk in a meatpacking plant, and he played like a street fighter. He also owned that image. Very literally, his nickname was Gloves Colombo because he wore gloves on the field. Not like winter gloves or working gloves, but actual boxing gloves, which now happen to hang in the Soccer Hall of Fame. Let's stick with that St. Louis contingent, Frank Pee Wee Wallace. He was also a starter, he was also a forward, and he scored 2 goals in those Cuba qualifying games that got them to Brazil for the World Cup. Then there was Gino Pariani. He played inside right. It's the equivalent of a midfield position today. He was small but tough, and also longtime teammates with Wallace and friends with Colombo. Frank Borghi, there's a name you should know. He was the team's goalkeeper and a native from St. Louis. He rounded out the group from the Hill. An aspiring catcher with dreams of playing for the Cardinals like Garagiola or the Yankees like Berra. He never had dreams of playing on the U.S. men's national team, but he played goalkeeper largely like he played baseball, with great hands. Keogh was another of the 6 from St. Louis and one of the 5 starters, another defender, and he was the only one of the group that grew up outside the Hill, instead part of a largely Spanish neighborhood despite his very Irish roots. Clarky Suso is the inside left, opposite Pariani from Fall River, Massachusetts. He had the skill of a natural footballer, and he was described by other players as the most talented of the group. Then there was Ed Suso, a forward, also Portuguese, also from Fall River, but no relation to Clarky. Joe Macca stripped wallpaper on Long Island, and he played opposite Keogh at left back. And of course, there's Joe Gaetjens. Now, why do I say of course? Because he's the name so many people have heard through the lens of this story. He was the center forward, the striker, and he'd play a big role in the outcome. Gaetjens was also interesting on so many levels. He was 26, of Haitian and Belgian descent, having come to the U.S. from Haiti. He was both washing dishes in New York and studying accounting part-time at Columbia. and he was a relative unknown as a soccer player to most on the team, considered a bit eccentric by pretty much all accounts. But he was big, strong, athletic, and he played with his hair on fire, throwing his body at the ball whenever he had an opportunity. Those were the 11 that would take the field that day, and since there were no subs allowed at the time, the only 11 that would play. They were a melting pot of people, of players, and of soccer styles. Then there was another character in the story, a cameo. He was the man that followed the team. Remember, no one cared about the U.S. heading to the World Cup. Well, almost no one. Dent McSkimming was the exception. The name is so good that it can't be real. Except, it's very real. He was a veteran reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and as someone that loved soccer and saw the connection to his city, he pitched the paper on covering the World Cup. And they said no. But he didn't let that stop him. Instead, he took 2 weeks vacation and paid his own way to Brazil to cover the tournament. And despite being on vacation, he covered the team for the Post-Dispatch. Initial reports didn't have his byline, while stories a few weeks later did, and Stefan Fatsis wrote a fantastic article about the backstory on his coverage in Slate. It's worth reading to learn more, so check out the show notes for a link to the article. Still, his personal trip and coverage of that game cemented McSkimming as one of the forefathers of soccer coverage, of soccer writing, of soccer reporting. He is one of the reasons this game is a key moment in the growth of the sport in our country. He was the first Grant Wall, a brilliant writer who saw something in the game that the broader public struggled to see, but he covered it anyway. He gave it a voice. He gave it visibility. You can't watch the U.S. take on England in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, just 300 miles north of Rio de Janeiro, on YouTube. Clips of the game exist, still images exist, but there's no full video. So any account of the gameplay that you find is just based on observation, either the few contemporaneous first-hand accounts or players recounting the game after the fact, often years after the fact. That said, it was largely what you'd have expected from the advertised mismatch. Despite not having their best player, Stanley Matthews, on the field, and that was because of a combination of his trip to North America for a club tour and the idea, frankly, that England simply didn't need him to beat the Americans. Despite all of that, England dominated the game immediately. They won the coin toss, had possession of the ball off the first whistle, and charged down the field within moments. Their technical mastery was clear. They passed with ease. The likes of Finney, Stanley Mortensen, and Billy Wright, they exerted their will, moving the ball into the attacking half of the field. And within 90 seconds, England had its first dangerous shot, and the U.S. had yet to even touch the ball. The first half continued much the same way. England was possessing at will, connecting passes like Prime Barcelona, Finney, Minion, Mortensen. They had 6 shots within 12 minutes and a dozen shots within the first 22 minutes. Despite being outmatched, the Americans had 2 things going for them. The first was defensive organization, playing in today's equivalent of what people call, say, a low block. When England got deep into the attacking third, they would encounter a line of resistance from Barr, McIlvenny, Maka, Keogh, Colombo, and eventually Frank Borghi. That was the second thing they had going for them that day. When the history of this game was written, and as it's recounted to this day, Borghi is rightly the hero. The baseball player turned goalkeeper turned in the performance of a lifetime. As England relentlessly attacked, Borghi grew into the game. He made diving saves, leaping saves, all of the saves that needed to be made, Borghi made. There were also uncharacteristic and what can only be described as fluky misses. When the English had their best chances, like the 31st minute when Mortensen had a wide open 1v1 against Borghi, he skied it over the bar. And it wasn't the first or last time that would happen. England missed a number of what were considered easy shots. But when it didn't happen, see, Borghi was there. It was the perfect storm of luck and skill for the Americans, and it was taking shape. And then in the 37th minute, the U.S. had its chance. Barr received a throw-in from McIlvenny on the England half of the field, and Barr sprinted nearly 20 yards towards the goal before any England player challenged him. That player finally was Billy Wright, and with Wright closing in, Barr delivered what was intended to be a shot towards goal. By all accounts, it was well hit, but goalkeeper Bert Williams just had to move to his right to collect the ball with relative ease near the far post. And that's when something miraculous happened. See, it should have been a routine save, but instead, Joe Gaetjens intervened. Specifically, the head of Joe Gaetjens. Keogh believes the forward dove some 12 or 14 feet towards the ball as it was crossing diagonally over the penalty spot and somehow managed a glancing header that redirected it past Williams into the back of the net. 1-0, USA. England tried to roar back, finding dangerous chances late in the first half, but they ran into that wall and then into Frank Borgi. So at halftime, the Americans still led 1-0. It's said that halftime didn't bring any rousing speeches. I mean, how could it? No one surely knew what to say. But when the second half started, England played with what could maybe be described as respect for the Americans. They still dominated the ball, but it reads like a game of something more closely approaching equals. England definitely had more chances, but the U.S. had a few of its own, including another header by Gaetjens that closely missed early in the second half. The crowd, 30,000 strong, they were getting behind the underdogs and began urging them to score another. One notable factor that surrounded the Americans and their amateur status was fitness. Since they didn't play soccer full-time, they just weren't as fit as other teams. When they had previously played well against top international teams, and it did happen, the outcome was often decided late in the game when their fitness faltered, when their legs were tired. That had been the story when they played Spain in their first group stage game at the World Cup. The U.S. scored early, a goal in the 17th minute by Pariani, and they held that lead into the final 10 minutes of the game when Spain scored 3 in just over 8 minutes against the tired Americans. See, observers felt the same was happening just 12 or 15 minutes into the second half against England. They were sharper, they looked more dangerous. The U.S., meanwhile, was just hanging on. But that's exactly what they did. They mustered the will to hang on. Whenever there was an England break, last-ditch efforts by McIlvenny, Keogh, or Clarkie Sousa, who was by all accounts tireless, those last-ditch efforts that kept their lead. 20 minutes to go, then 10, still leading 1-0, the impossible was becoming possible. With 8 minutes left, Mortensen broke free and dashed down the field towards Borgi, but somehow, miraculously, Colombo gave chase and made a late diving tackle to save an England goal. It was a clear foul, but outside the 18, it avoided a penalty, instead giving the English an indirect kick. Alf Ramsey took that kick. He delivered a clip ball to Jimmy Mullen, who headed it somewhat controversially, maybe across the line or maybe not, before Borgi brushed it away. But either way, the referee said it wasn't a goal, and the U.S. retained its lead. That would be the last great chance the English had. And despite exhaustion, the likes of Clarkie Sousa found the energy to dribble out time when it was needed. And when the final whistle blew, the impossible was done. David had slain Goliath with a soccer ball. For England, the immediate aftermath was more significant than it was for the U.S. They were unable to recover from the loss, losing again just 3 days later, on July 2nd, to Spain. The final was 1-0. It was a close game, but for England, it was another upset. They didn't even make it out of the group round and flew home a few days later as one of the greatest underperforming teams in World Cup history. For the U.S., the win was almost immediately forgotten. It barely made a ripple in the American landscape. The Post-Dispatch, because of McSkimming, was the only paper to cover the game in anything resembling a timely fashion. Others that reported the score at a later point did it with inconsistency. See, many papers believe the final score they received via wire was an error or some change the score based on conjecture. Other papers suspecting some type of joke, they simply didn't print anything. The U.S. also played on July 2nd and also lost. Their game was maybe more interesting. Facing Chile, they went down 2 goals early, came back and tied the game before ultimately losing 5-2. Fitness, it betrayed them again, so there was no knockout stage for the Americans either. 2 weeks later, Uruguay defeated Brazil in the final, giving the fans enough of an upset that most would forget the bigger one that had taken place earlier in the tournament. It began a trend that continued for 40 years. Few stories were written about the game. Few conversations about the game's significance were had because on the surface, there wasn't much significance. The U.S. didn't advance, the victory didn't bring glory, nor did it advance the state of U.S. soccer. But it was the first of many interconnected moments. That win in the 1950 World Cup, it mattered on levels that we wouldn't realize for decades. Today's guest on the Founding Football Podcast is Jeffrey Douglas, author of The Game of Their Lives.
Thanks for the invitation, Ken. I appreciate it. I'd like to be here. Good to be here.
You have a great resume. You've written other books. You have taught writing at UMass as well as English. You were a journalist for a long time. So I really want to start with how you came to this book. I understand that really the idea or the inspiration for writing this was based on a newspaper article you read. Talk a little bit about how you got into that, mm-hmm. how you found the story and what you found interesting about it.
Well, it was 1994. And I had written at that point three books. Two books. And they'd both been fairly dark books. And I was kind of hoping to find something a little more uplifting to get into. And at that point, in this spring of 1994, that's when the World Cup came to the U.S. It was based in the U.S. And Boston was one of the venues. And so the Boston Globe covered it extensively. And there was an article in the Boston Globe sometime in the spring of 1984 about this team from 1950 that I had never heard of, that had defeated England in what they were calling the greatest upset in the history of soccer. I thought, and there were a bunch of immigrant sons, you know, and that just sounded so interesting to me. And
I'm really curious about your relationship to soccer before you started writing the story. Was it something
not
that you
much,
followed as a fan?
Not much. Yeah. I mean, I played it in high school.
Okay.
I played it in high school. I was on the team in high school, but that's it. I always liked it. But I didn't really have much of a relationship to soccer. I mean, one of my big incentives in writing this book had less to do with soccer than it did with the team itself. I was very impressed by this idea of a group of immigrant sons in ethnic communities all over the U.S. It wasn't just St. Louis, yep. but it was mostly, who had kept playing soccer pretty much for the love of it. Yep. And that just seemed, you know, really like a great place to start. Which is kind of where the title came, The Game of Their Lives.
Yeah.
A lot of the book, as you know, is about their lives. And these are guys who married their first girlfriend and went to the same church for 50 years, you know, and buried in the same church. And it's so at odds with the way the country was then and even more is now.
So let's talk about the comment you just made. This is a theme I really want to dig into. And frankly, that I think is a part of the through line for soccer in this country, but really this game and the makeup of this team, which was immigrant communities. Mm-hmm. A big piece of how soccer remained relevant, there was an effort for soccer to become more mainstream early in the 1900s, and then a number of political battles between the various professional leagues led to the soccer war, the depression came. Soccer mm-hmm. kind of disappeared, but you do a really good job in the book talking about how it stayed alive in these immigrant communities. And in particular, you dive into the Hill in St. Louis. So what were your findings? What did you think about the critical kind of makeup of immigrant communities keeping soccer alive?
I thought it was wonderful the way it happened. It happened because in a lot of the major metropolitan areas in the East, you know, these are teams or ethnic communities themselves, you know, sort of fund the teams. But in St. Louis and in also, I think, in parts of New Jersey, they were funded by the church yeah. and later by companies. In St. Louis, there was a team called Cudas Funeral Home, another one called right. Simpkins Ford. And these companies, sometimes very small companies, local companies, would pay for the uniforms, pay for the refs, and then at the end, you know, the players would pass around a hat and they'd maybe make 40, 50 bucks. And yeah. that's how they kept it going. And I just thought that was so wonderful and such a contrast to where we are today in professional sports in our country. And I just kind of fell in love with the whole concept.
Yeah, and you have some really descriptive passages in the book about how, you know, if you were part of a community where there were a number of Spanish immigrants, they would be following Real Madrid back home. But in contrast, and this is one of the things I really found so fascinating about the exploration and some of the key characters in your book, baseball was a big part of their lives, right? Mm-hmm. So in America at the time, baseball was the sport that potentially got you out of your maybe poor immigrant community. In St. Louis, Joe Garagiola's, you know, the native son who made good. Did you get a sense in your conversations that there was this contrast that soccer was almost a secondary sport and that people really had other aspirations, either trying to play baseball to get out? You know, that was certainly something that all these different individuals had in mind.
Frank Borghi got a tryout and actually was on a farm team for the professionals. And that's what he really wanted to do. But I guess he wasn't quite good enough. But I think soccer was, no, I wouldn't call it an afterthought to football, I mean, to baseball.
Okay.
It was such a, in those communities, especially St. Louis and the Hill, it was a very dominant thing. You know, Joe Garagiola and Yogi Berra were big models and people wanted, everybody loved them. Everybody loved football, but soccer was always bigger there than you would have known it anywhere else, almost anywhere else in the country, except maybe Fall River or Providence, Rhode Island was another one, and Philadelphia and New York, you know, but nothing like St. Louis. It started in the teens, 1915, they had a league, and that sort of died out when the Depression came because they ran out, the companies that were subsidizing them, buying the uniforms, couldn't afford it anymore, and then the war came. And that took out most of the kids out, you know, but it never really died in St. Louis.
Yeah. And I think that's, I'm glad you said all that because that was the sense I wanted to get from the conversations you had, the research you did. Baseball was a very well-established professional sport. There was a lot of money in it, but it did feel like soccer was important to these communities. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe they played baseball and Frank Borghi had the ability to at least play at a minor league level, but soccer mattered, right? It was something that was really a part of their community DNA. This was almost exemplary of America at the time. Immigrant communities, but certainly a number of individuals who came together from different parts of the country it was a really interesting mix. It was almost a melting pot of individuals on this team. What was your take on kind of their thoughts of being brought together in the selection process?
The first generation, their fathers, they didn't have time to play soccer.
They were too busy
working, you know, but they passed it on to their kids. None of these people, only one of the players on the U.S. team was a first generation American. But you also have to come in. The church was a big factor.
Yeah.
St. Ambrose Parish. I don't know if I mentioned that in the book. I think I probably did.
Yep.
St. Ambrose Parish, as the kids were young, they played for the church teams and the church funded it. And this is, you know, 6, 8, 9, 10 year olds. Then they go on and they play for Cuda's Funeral Home or Simpkins Ford or Correnti Cleaners. And it just, between the church and the local community and the commercial community, that really kept it alive.
Yeah, that's great. So sense of community, right? Passing this on from one generation to the next. Frankly, a game that they loved in their homeland, bringing it together. The churches bring groups together. Lots of description about how they would just play all the time. And then all of a sudden you have this group from St. Louis. You have this group or an individual, Walter Barr from Philadelphia, and you know, Joe Gatchins is obviously Haitian American. It's an incredible combination of individuals. The team took a lot of pride, though, that unlike some of the other, let's say, larger, more dominant federations, they were kind of scrappy, right? Was that a big part of their identity?
Very scrappy. Look at Charlie Colombo, how scrappy he was. He's so scrappy, he tackled somebody football style in the middle of the game. They were very scrappy. And a lot of these guys outside of the St. Louis didn't know each other.
Yep.
Those five guys, of course, did, but nobody had met Joe Gatchins before. I guess they knew Walter Barr, but they didn't know Clarky Sousa, I don't think.
Yeah.
So these guys all came together, and they only came together for 2 weeks before they went to Brazil. And they had almost no time to practice. And, you know, I know you know this because you read the book, but they played an exhibition game in New York on Randall's Island against the English B team and got dubbed, thrubbed, just clobbered. So the idea of playing the A team and doing any better was pretty much out of the question. They were total underdogs.
No question. So let's talk a little bit about the actual World Cup. You do a great job contextualizing it, right? There's so much going on in the country. Soccer's an afterthought. One journalist pays his own way.
His name is Dent McSkimmy.
Dent McSkimmy. When I read that, I thought, this is made for a movie. But so little coverage, right? This team didn't have the glamour, the spotlight that is put on any level of national team now. Very low expectations. They're put in a group round with England. They play Spain first. They lose 3-1. Although there were some really positive outcomes of that game, right?
They played well in that game. I think they might have scored the first goal. They might have been up 1-0. I'm not sure. Yeah. Harry Keogh told me they just got tired. They didn't have the conditioning that these other teams did. But they played well. I think they scared Spain a little bit.
So based on the conversations and the research you did, they play England in the second game. Try to articulate just how much of a David and Goliath type matchup this is. You read it, but I think it's still probably underappreciated. Is there a comparison you can make? Describe just how much of a force England was in the soccer community in 1950.
The U.S. beating England that year would be like Bermuda beating the dream team in basketball.
That's a good comparison.
That would about be the analogy. I mean, it would be almost virtually impossible. You know, so they came down there and they had met each other before, 2 weeks before. They didn't know each other. They barely practiced together. But there was a chemistry, apparently, that they all talked about when I met with them. And they went down and they were 500-1 in the English bookies, 500-1. Could have been 10,000-1. They were given no chance. That was to win the cup, of course, which they didn't do. But the idea of them beating England was absolutely out of question. England has their best player was a guy named Stanley Matthews. He was the best player on the English team, and maybe the best player in the world. And he didn't even play. They arrested him. They figured they'd need him more against Chile. And so that's how confident they were. So the idea of losing was just unheard of. And they really were, in fairness, any of the team's players would have told you this, they were dominated. They won the game, but they were totally dominated. And the hero was, without question, was Frank Borghi. I mean, Joe Gaetjen scored the goal. It was a fluke goal. But Frank Borghi was made apparent. I mean, there's not a lot of footage of this game available, but where there is, you see a few. He had an amazing ability. First of all, he had hands the size of, I don't know, hams. You know, they were huge hands. And he had an ability to, a very tall guy, leap up high into the air. He would charge out and leap up and get balls that no one else could possibly have reached. And he had so many stops, so many blocks. And he was just he played the game of his life. And I'm sure they were outshot 10-1, but they won. You know, and they scored in the end of the first half, and incredible shot off Gaetjen's, grazed Gaetjen's head. Everything about it was a miracle. It really was.
I have to ask you about the Gaetjen's goal, because you do a great job in the book saying it happened. Everyone says it happened. But if you talk to people, there's some people that aren't really sure if it happened or how it happened, because it seems so improbable the way he threw his body towards, you know, essentially was a cross. Is there any sort of clear recollection that differs between the players?
Well, all the players that I spoke with, they all expressed astonishment at how it happened.
Yeah.
Because Walter Barr hit a long cross from midfield. You know, I think I described it, a very long cross into the penalty zone. And it was, there's a still photo, or maybe it's a video even today, of Bert Williams, I think his name was, the English goalkeeper. Waiting, watching the ball come and standing like this, waiting. And then all of a sudden, the next shot is he's looking behind him and the ball's in the back of the net. And Gaetjen's had leaped up and some part of his head had grazed the ball and just changed the trajectory a little bit. And you know, there you have Bert Williams still waiting to catch the ball and it's in the net behind him. It was amazing. A fluke goal, you know.
Unbelievable.
They carried Gaetjen's off the field as well as Borghi. The fans did. The fans loved it.
So you mentioned earlier that both the book and for anyone that's listening that hasn't read it, you do a really masterful job weaving gameplay description and segments of the game as a chapter in between the stories of the individuals. It's really compelling in that regard. And one thing that you just referenced is how little footage there is. So I wondered, from a process standpoint, how did you describe play on the field? Was that through the memories of the players that you had a chance to speak to? Was it through some footage? What was that process like?
There's very little footage, video footage, almost very little. Although, interestingly, since you called me, I looked again. There's now I've seen a little bit more than I got before, because there was no, when I wrote this book, the internet wasn't really a factor. It was in 1994 or five or whenever I wrote it. But the, really, even today, there's almost none. And yes, I got the story almost entirely from the players. But they all really, they were uniform in their view. I mean, there was no disagreement, no dispute about how it happened. And so I was able to recreate the game using their accounts and my imagination to kind of recreate the game and the flow of play.
Incredible.
I worked hard at that. That was hard. That was the hardest part of the book, was to do that.
I can imagine. And it was really well done, particularly for someone, as you said, if you really didn't play soccer beyond, you know, your youth, it's not something that probably you were thinking about regularly describing gameplay. Mm-hmm. But it was great. So the idea of this podcast is really thinking about how different moments in soccer history help the progress of the game. And this is the first moment I chose. And it's interesting in that regard, because you say in the book, and if you read other articles, you're quoted in an article that I read on CNN.com, for example, for 30 years, people forgot about this game.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, because I think that's an important point. People forgot about it almost right away. Isn't that fair to say?
Almost right away. I mean, as we know, as we've discussed, only one reporter from the U.S. even covered the game. This is a World Cup. And his editor wouldn't pay him to go down there, so he had to go down on his own dime. That was Dent McSkimming. And when I've heard, there's some question about this, but when the New York Times, it came over the wire that the game was won by the U.S., 1-0, the New York Times wouldn't print it because they assumed it was a typo. They just assumed there was just no chance that could have happened. Nobody paid any attention to the game. The players themselves didn't realize. They'll tell you, they say, oh yes, Harry Keogh would say, it was really great. That game was really great. It was really fun. But the really big game was when his team was Kuta's funeral home. When Kuta's beat Simpkins Ford in 48, that was really big. They didn't even understand what an enormous impact this was in the rest of the world. They came home from this from the World Cup, and they're met at the airport by their friends and their girlfriends and their wives. One of them was docked in pay for missing work. They didn't. There was just no concept at all of what this game meant to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
The game was, to follow up on what I was saying before, the game was basically ignored during that time. And then 25 years later, every 4 years, reporters would start calling these guys. Back in the 70s, when the World Cup happened, they started getting phone calls. That was when soccer had picked up in America and was beginning to be a college sport. And then after 1980, it was routine. The phone would ring every 4 years, never in between, but every 4 years. So that's how it happened. They could measure the increase in interest in soccer from the number of phone calls they made at World Cup time.
Did they have a sense that they had been part of the reason at that point? Did they feel like they had created momentum?
I think for the first time they did. I don't think at the time they recognized it all. They didn't recognize it all. You have to worry about getting paid for the time you missed. You're not really thinking about the impact you made in the world.
Yeah.
But they came to recognize it through those phone calls. Okay. So by the time I called them, I don't think any of them were that surprised. But I was the only one who wanted to write a book about it. All the others were magazine pieces, you know, story, newspaper pieces.
They probably loved having their story captured, though, in a way that hadn't been done before.
They enjoyed talking about it.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you probably spent the most time with Harry Keogh. Is that correct?
Maybe. Probably. He met my plane. So, yeah.
And I only ask in the context of how much you got into beyond this game and, you know, his time at St. Louis University and the other things he did. Obviously, his son became a big part of the college soccer and U.S. national team landscape as well. So I'm kind of curious if that was part of the conversations you had with him.
I spent more time with him. And then second would be Walter Barr.
Okay.
Because when I went to Philadelphia, there was no one to compete for his time. I mean, it was just one player I went to see. But Harry Keough, Harry Keough was a very modest guy. He was really, you had to ask him anything you wanted to know about. He would never volunteer that he did this or he did that or what a great defender he was. He was just, he was key to the team. He talked about his coaching. He said it was as gratifying to him, every bit as gratifying as his playing. He coached at St. Louis University. Yep. And he coached them to a bunch of NCAA championships. He and Barr were both coaches, you know, and they made an enormous impact on the future, on the today's soccer, you know. And you know, Walter Barr's sons went on to be NFL kickers because there was more money in that. They learned to kick by playing soccer. And then Matt Barr went on to kick the winning field goal in the Super Bowl. I mean, it's just amazing, the story.
And what a microcosmic example of the struggle of U.S. soccer, right? Mm-hmm. His dad is one of the preeminent coaches in collegiate soccer in the country. Mm-hmm. He certainly taught them the game, but then he even supported them leaving and going into football because he knew there was a greater opportunity for a career path. And I think that might even be different if it happened today, right, than when it happened a couple decades ago. Yeah.
It would be very different, but it's... But yeah, he supported it. And he, there was much more income to be made. It was much more of a future in every way. You know, Barr was really, Keough is the one certainly the one in the Hill I spent the most time with. But Barr was really the de facto captain of the team. He was the only person on the team who had a college education. He was the only one on the team, as far as I know, who came from what I would call a full middle class background. Hmm. And he was a very sophisticated guy. He was a very articulate guy. And, you know, Harry Keough, he grew up, he was Irish.
Yeah.
There was no Irish community in St. Louis.
There was
a Spanish community, and there was a German community, and there was an Italian, a huge Italian. But he grew up in Carondelet. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but the Carondelet region was the Spanish area. And so he kind of grew up playing as this Irish kid, playing soccer, scrub games of soccer against Spanish players. So you learned it that way.
I want to ask you, as someone that went through this process, and so much has changed since you wrote the book. You mentioned that really this was in and around the 1994 World Cup when there was interest in this story. You know, one of those many calls they got every 40 years starting in the 70s, every 4 years starting in the 70s. What's your biggest takeaway? How do you think Americans who are soccer fans should think about this group of players, the significance of this game?
Well, there's two answers to that. I mean, first is the significance of the game. It was clearly a landmark game in the history of soccer in this country. It was a turning point. It was a Cinderella story. It was wonderful. I mean, it began to put soccer on the map in the country. But also, to me, the even more important aspect is the way this team came together, this nucleus of immigrant sons who came together to play the game that they learned from their church and from their local companies. And whereas in the East Coast, teams were already, there was already a small professional league, and they were being subsidized by large donors. Here are these guys from St. Louis, and Joe Gatchens is a dishwasher in New York, and they're just playing on scrub fields on Saturdays for their church or for their funeral home or for their Ford company. And that, to me, was the real germ of the story. I just thought it was wonderful. It was so antithetical to so much else in our country and in the world. About pro sports, you know.
Right. So it's the idea that it made us believe we could be relevant in this sport that maybe really we didn't think we could be relevant in. We could be relevant in this sport with, to your point, people that were now really truly Americans, right? Second generation. So they are bringing a new identity together as a group that, you said it so well, was only together for 2 weeks, maybe knew about each other, maybe didn't. And even though that's not how it happens now, we still are bringing together individuals through the youth program, which clearly has so much more money and attention paid to it, mm-hmm. from different parts of the country with different styles, with different backstories. I mean, that's really what sports in this country is about, right? So right. It's a great point you're making. Is there anything you want people to really take away from, not the game and the significance, but some of these characters in the book who I think you clearly developed a great relationship with?
Well, I think the humility was, on a personal level, was the most outstanding quality that I encountered. None of these guys at all, even slightly. I mean, Frank Borghi just wouldn't talk about himself. He was the hero of that game. He wouldn't talk about himself. I never met Joe Gatchens because he was dead already, but apparently he was the same way. They were just very humble, self-effacing, decent people who had lived relatively simple lives and mostly pretty religious, you know, in the church. They were kind of harked back to a different America, I think, of maybe their father's America, where their fathers came from, the America of the 30s and 40s. And, you know, and they really were the hill. That was just a wonderful community, really wonderful community. And you know, these guys were just—they just loved talking about it. Nobody wanted to take credit. I'd tell Harry Keough that people calling him the greatest defender in the country. And no. And he'd start naming other people. And they were wonderful to be with. I mean, I never wanted that. I never wanted the story to end. I really wanted to stay out in St. Louis forever. I just thought it was great, you know.
Well, I agree with you. When I read it, I didn't want it to end. Jeffrey Douglas, author of The Game of Their Lives, The Untold Story of the World Cup's Biggest Upset, and, as we've talked about, a game that, frankly, many still call possibly the biggest upset in sports history, period. I'm really grateful that you were here. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Kent. Thanks for the invitation. I enjoyed it.
For as little attention as anyone paid to the win when it happened, it's now been told and retold many times, mostly in the last 3 decades, really starting with the 1994 World Cup coverage. Last year, during the 2022 World Cup, Brian Phillips put out a tremendous podcast called 22 Goals. Each episode told the story of an important goal in World Cup history, and his 9th episode recounts the Joe Gatchens goal that happened in this game. Many of the stories and facts he talks about are the same, some are different, but the most notable difference is his conclusion. Brian says that goal and that win, it was just all sort of an accident, an anomaly, that it didn't change the trajectory of the team in the World Cup, they flamed out as expected, or didn't change the trajectory of soccer in America at the time. We know that would take decades. Instead, he suggests there's no real historical meaning for us to associate with this win. That's where we part ways. Sometimes meaning is hard to see. Sometimes its impact on the next thing that has an impact on the next thing, that's the important part. It's the butterfly effect. This moment is the first of 52 that I've chosen that I believe starts a long journey back towards soccer emerging as a popular sport in America. If you think of each as a brick in a building, this is a foundational piece, a keystone event. That group of immigrants with different backgrounds bringing their own voice to a soccer pitch to create a new combined American flavor of the game, that was important. That they won gave us a single distinct moment of American ownership over a foreign game. It gave us highlights, it gave us heroes, Gatchens, Borghi. American sports lore is built on individual greatness. That moment also launched ambassadors who would do the same, do more actually, grow the game in America in immeasurable ways. In that respect, two stand tall in this group, Harry Keough and Walter Barr. It's possible that without this win, both men would become important figures in the landscape of American soccer anyway. But it's undeniable that the greatest win in the history of the national team was a resume booster that helped these two take steps that further advanced the game for generations to come. Barr became one of the most important college coaches of a generation. He started at Temple in 1970 and held that position for 3 years until taking the Penn State men's soccer position in 1974. He would remain in charge of the Nittany Lions program until 1988, and during his tenure, he would guide his team to 12 NCAA Division I tournament appearances. At the end of his coaching career, Barr was appointed to head U.S. soccer's delegations to various international competitions, and he ended up traveling with the men's national team to Russia, Hungary, and Poland, as well as to Italy for the 1990 FIFA World Cup. Barr also accompanied the U.S. women's national team to China in 1988 when FIFA staged a women's world championship. Keogh had a similar impact. He retired from playing in 1962, and he became St. Louis University's coach several years later. That made him a critical college coach as well, because at the time he was taking a job that many would argue was the top job in college soccer. Tune in next week to learn more about St. Louis University and Chapter 2 of Founding Football. But during his 16 seasons as coach of the Billikens, they won 213 games, made the NCAA playoffs 15 times, reached the title game in 6 consecutive years from 69 to 74, and won titles in 67, 69, 70, 72, and 73. He continued a dynasty. Among the players that Keogh coached at St. Louis was his son Ty, who also played later for the United States in World Cup qualifying in 1980. And let's not forget about Mick Skimming, a reporter that tirelessly made it his mission to cover soccer, to give it a voice, a man who made it possible for people like Phillips and Wall to cover the game at scale decades later. The goal, the game, the victory over the greatest team in the world. It may have been an accident. It may have been an anomaly. It may be something that in a vacuum doesn't have historical meaning. But the momentum that it created, the trends that it began, the outcome that it triggered, those things do matter. The men that took the inertia created on that day in June of 1950 and directed it towards the growth of soccer in this country, that has meaning. They are a critical reason that soccer has become popular in this country. Thank you for listening to Chapter 1 of Founding Football, the 1950 World Cup game between the U.S. and England. I'm your host, Kent Malmrose. This episode features original music by Hayden Malmrose. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review Founding Football. For more information or show notes, visit our website at foundingfootball.com. We'll be back next week with Chapter 2, the 1959 NCAA Championship game.